picking up session 2 on Thursday, the 15th of January 2015. Zoe Perry and Margaret Turner. We spoke earlier, covered a couple of, there were some acronyms that came up. So, Margaret, if you wouldn't mind, just sort of, if we go through those and you can explain to me what they are. The UNA?
UNA is the United Nations Association.
Thank you. The IMF?
IMF, the International Monetary Fund.
The IEC?
This is a WILF body, the International Executive Committee, now called the Board, but we used to call it the IEC.
I understand. And you also mentioned the WTO, I think.
WTO, the World Trade Organization.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So to continue our conversation...
I would like to pay tribute to the women that I have met internationally and nationally who are dedicated, have done so much for peace. WILF is only a means to an end. What we're aiming at is peace and justice. And there are women that have gone in the past that have led to what we have now. There are women in many different countries. I've mentioned a few of them, a few that I met. In my early years as a WILF member, and one or two later. I mentioned Nellie Weiss, whose whole life I am ignorant about, but I know that it was a life of activity. But I got to know her daughter, Mary Pym, much better. Mary was not the international personality that her mother was, but she was a very good woman nevertheless, and she enabled her mother to go on to quite an advanced age. I don't want to mention any other British women by name. I have mentioned a few of them. They've all been very good to work with. And of the international women, as I mentioned, Hannan Awad of the Palestinian section has been a driver there for the Palestinian cause. I'd like to mention Alia Strauss, who was the president of the Israeli section for many years, and worked equally hard for her peace on the other side of that issue. Other international women, Edith Ballantyne struck me from the start as a woman of stature, and I think she is still probably an advisor, certainly has been until recent years. I don't think I'll mention any other women except that there are many known and unknown who we deserve to think about and remember at our 100th anniversary. Okay.
Thank you. You've spoken a lot about strong women within the organisation. Can you elaborate about that strength?
Well, strength does sometimes lead to opposition because we have women with very strong feelings. So you have to be... you have to try and be gentle with your strength as well, I think. That's important. And to be prepared to listen to everybody. Without the strength, you wouldn't get anywhere, would you? But you have to be firm but gentle, I think. And we do need a lot of tolerance as well, to be able to see things from all sides. And this is what WILF tries to do. Whenever there is a conflict in any part of the world, we don't take sides. We try to... There is usually good on both sides and usually something to be against on both sides. And we try and get that balance between the two. It's not easy.
you've also spoken about a lot of practical economic issues. Would you like to elaborate?
It was sort of the economic injustice, although I didn't use those phrases in the past. It was poverty and the fact that some are rich and some are poor, and the poor might be just as hardworking as the rich. Poverty isn't a result of laziness necessarily, it's a result of conditions. That was what made me want to join an organisation that fought for justice, as well as racism, which is related to poverty in many ways. But then what I learnt from Wilf was that you cannot separate this from militarism and human rights, or ignoring human rights. So they are interlinked. They all go together. We have to work for the lot. And Wilf is that holistic organisation that looks at things from a holistic point of view. That's what I like about it. It tries to see all sides of a problem, and it tries to see what the relationship between the different problems. The fact that I prefer to work on the economic justice side is just my interest. But all of those aspects are important, yes. And I did think that Wilf didn't pay enough attention to the economic justice side at one time, but and maybe that is still true to some extent. I do think that I mentioned this morning this TTIP that is being discussed at high levels at the moment, and that very few of us know anything about. And it will give so much power to the big national corporations, power over individual lives, because we know with the genetic modification that's going on. My objection to this is not because I think it will damage our health, but the fact that it gives the power to the corporations to hold the patent for the seeds. And this, it would be disastrous for countries where they're used to saving their seeds from year to year, so that they can keep on growing their crops. If they're patented by big corporations, this robs them of the power to do that. So these are the issues that I am concerned about, together with environmental issues, which affect the whole world, but they do affect the poorer people more deeply than the other. The rich can afford to have their air conditioning and their comforts around them, but the poor cannot. And their conditioning is just rather one trivial aspect of it. But the rich can buy their way out of the misery, and the poor have to put up with it. So international movements are just necessary for this, and also international movements that involve the people who are suffering from them, not just the ones who think they know what the answers are and try and impose them from on top, but the people who are actually on the ground that know what conditions are like for them, and have a better idea than the highly educated technicians about what is needed.
You mentioned highly educated technicians there.
Yes, they're important, and my background is scientific anyway, and I do think sometimes when I hear about these missions to Mars and so on, knowledge is important. As a human race, we seek advancement of knowledge, and how to reconcile the vast sums spent on these things with the poverty in the world is difficult. I'm not opposed to scientific research, but there's got to be a balance somewhere, and And it's sometimes the poorer people that know. They know what's necessary for life. Probably better than the ones who live in a tower somewhere or in a scientific cell. No. There's a lot of discussion in the UK right now about the National Health Service and quality of life as opposed to length of life. And to me, that's important as well, isn't it? Living longer isn't a virtue. There's nothing particularly good about living a long time. It's the sort of life that you live that's more important than that.
And do you think organisations like WILPF are important in achieving?
Yes, because people can't do a lot as individuals. They can only achieve things by working as a body. I think one individual might have a lot of influence maybe within an organisation, I don't know, but... And I suppose a few individuals in the world have had influence just because of themselves. I mean, think people like Nelson Mandela and Mother Teresa had a big influence, but then they did work within groups, they didn't work as individuals. So yes, WILPF is important so that women as a body can work for what their ideals. And with men, but I mean, it's necessary for women to work separately from men as well, because they have been overlooked so much in the past. I mean, that's not just in the field of that we're thinking of now, but you know, all fields of knowledge, scientists themselves, women have not had the the respect that they have deserved. Sometimes they've not had the opportunity to do things because of their sex, and those that have been sidelined to some extent. One of the problems is, of course, that the people say that so much good in the way of technical aids to life comes out of war, that the scientists' research for improved weaponry leads to commodities that are good for care of humans in hospitals and so on. The sad thing is that this research should be able to go ahead regardless of, without the need to research for weapons. The scientists should have the motivation and the backing to do research for human good, for human life, rather than for improved weapons of war. But listening to so many and watching programmes on television and on radio about life in the past, about other civilizations that have passed, they always seem to have gone in for war, first of all. Very few of them seem to have gone in for development without conquering others. Whether that is true or not, I'm not a historian, but I do enjoy going into that, learning what I can about past history now from archaeology and so on.
You mentioned past history, and I understand that you've deposited items.
Sorry?
I understand that you've deposited items in the archive.
Yes. Well, mainly papers, mainly, but I think I might have sent. I don't know. I don't know whether I sent. I know I sent the recordings of Mary Phillips and Lois Evans. I'm pretty certain I sent those to the archives, yes. Other items, I don't know. I mean, I haven't had that many, but I must have had something from South Africa. I don't know what's happened to that.
Speaking of South Africa, you said you were part of a small group there, not really large enough to be part of a delegation.
Geneva office sent letters, presumably to all the sections, messages asking if anybody in their country would volunteer to go. And as I went from this country, and it was up to whether other countries, maybe they couldn't afford it, maybe they, or what. But all I know is that there was one from Canada, one from the US, one from Australia, one from Holland. I think there were seven altogether, so might have been one or two more. But another woman from UK was very disappointed that she was not asked to go. In fact, she was very emotionally involved in South Africa because she had lived there for many years, and a very good woman who'd spent her life helping other people as a nurse in various capacities in various war-torn countries. And she was quite upset, but she was older, and there was supposed to be an old age limit, even though the woman from Canada ignored that age limit. But also, I think she would have been too emotionally involved to be there as an observer. Anyway, she didn't get. We were the only two that volunteered in the UK. Not that there was much time, so as soon as I volunteered at a committee meeting, I think that was just it, really. Didn't ask for any, because I was on the exec anyway, so that was it, it went in. But then the Wilf delegation, maybe we got involved too late. It was, I think, only in the January. And we were too small a body to go, to be accepted as a group. So we went under the auspices of the World Council of Churches. Wilf is non-denominational, non-religious, but there are many different religions and non-believers within it. So we went as that. But it was, to be honest, the involvement was a bit chaotic when we got to South Africa. We just spent so much time, Sylvia and myself, who were left in Johannesburg after others had gone, wondering what was going to happen to us, thinking they'd forgotten about us, because we were just told to sit and in our hotels and be by the telephone and not getting any messages. So we felt as though we were almost lost, but somehow we did get incorporated in the last minute, and we did play. We're very happy to play our part. Most impressed by the two men we were with, particularly the older one, who has belonged to a choir in his own township, and he said that he was involved in a concert after the elections were over, but before the inauguration of President Mandela, and we stayed behind. Sylvia and I paid for any extra expenses involved ourselves, and we moved to a cheaper place. We moved to the YWCA once the election had finished, so that we could live more cheaply. And he said there was going to be this concert. We said we'd love to go, and he said, right, I will take you then. And we didn't hear about from him for a couple of weeks, thought, oh, he's forgotten about it. But on the day of the concert, and I'd gone to church and I was late coming back, he was there waiting to take us to this township where there were four or five different African choirs from different places, some all men and some mixed. And it was the most astonishing concert I've ever been to. It was the life, the vitality, the rhythm, as they, you know, they were a singing group, but Africans can't sing without moving. So there was this rhythm, dance, half dancing, but all the time. It was astonishing. I just wish I had a recording of it. And he was they were trying to make money to go on a tour in the US somewhere. And we did both say we would like recordings, but I never had any contact with him afterwards. But there we were, we're the only two white people in this concert hall, which struck me very much like a parish hall in UK, where a sort of community centre. And the man who'd taken us, Abel, I think he was called, introduced us, and we had to stand up and be acknowledged there. That was an outstanding experience, really. Another experience there was when we, the four of us, in the car that we hired, drove past the main buildings. Oh, I cannot remember names any longer, but the buildings that you see when you ever see a photograph of Pretoria as being where the centre of government. And there were these buildings and a road in front, and then a large, large grassy slope where the people gathered for the inauguration ceremony, and where they had gathered before the elections as well to sort of build themselves up for the elections. But when we drove along this road, these two, and we did have a photograph taken of the four of us up there, they said, we weren't allowed up here before. We were not allowed to be on this road so near the Constitution buildings, you know. So that was quite an experience. But what else? Before the elections started, when we'd actually got to Pretoria and had to wait for a day or two then to get more messages, so we did a bit of wandering around, and we met a young man who was desperately keen to get involved in being an observer himself, partly, I think, because he needed the money and the observers were paid. We didn't, not the international observers, but the local observers got paid. Anyway, he insisted on taking us around and taking us on the cheap transport that was only for black Africans. They have their own minibus service, and because they needed it, because they weren't allowed on white transport. So this service they set up to... Anyway, when we got on one of them, there was quite a lot of fuss and we didn't know what it was all about. But we discovered because they didn't want white people on that bus. and that happened once or twice, yes. And there was another occasion when the elections were over and Sylvia had gone to the Kalahari. I hadn't made a brief visit to the Kruger National Park, but she'd gone off on a longer thing. And so I spent quite a bit of time just walking around Pretoria. And on one occasion, I'd gone farther than I realised. And it was getting dusk and I was in a black part of the town. And there were black people coming out of work, going for these buses to take them to the township, and I realised that it wasn't quite the right place for me to be. But I had a map, so I was walking away from the black area towards the white area, came to a busy road, and a black woman escorted me across the road. I suppose she must have asked me who I was and whatnot. And as I got across the road, she checked that I knew where I was going. And then she said, "You must take care." And then I walked along and I got to the white area and I heard loud footsteps behind me. And a tall Afrikaans man caught up with me and he talked to me and learnt what I was. And when we got opposite the YWCA where I was staying, he saw me cross the road and he said, "You must take care." So they were both, he was very strong Afrikaans. He knew what I'd been doing and I don't suppose he approved of it, but he conducted me safely to my residence. And, the Afrikaans people that I met, they seemed to be prepared to make the best of it. Not all that happy, but to make the best of it. And I booked a short trip. Sylvia McFadden-Jones was an extraordinary character. I mean, she's not British Wilf, but she's an extraordinary character. She had been born in Estonia. At the age of 18, 19, spent 12 months in a concentration camp and then escaped first to UK and then to Canada. And she now considered herself a Canadian. That's what she was, a Canadian. But a very strong personality. I mean, she'd gone through a lot in her life, I think. And she was determined to see as much as she can. And she'd been to the Kruger Park before it started. And afterwards, she went to the Kalahari. And urged me to book for the Kruger for a short 3-day trip because the inauguration ceremony was a couple of weeks ahead, anyway. So I went and a young woman took just two of us, a German journalist and myself. And she was absolutely hooked, and the Kruger National Park and the animals were there were so important to her. She just wondered what effect, and she and her fiance, who was taking my friend Sylvia to the Kalahari at the same time on a much tougher expedition, wondered what effect this change would have on her business. That was all that concerned her. She felt quite, didn't care whether it was a white or a black government, but how it affect her business. And we assured her that it would improve it tremendously because a lot of people have been boycotting. So she was quite surprised at that. And we talked a bit about racism. And she said one day, "I'm not a racist. Even my servant has tea with me." so that was her attitude anyway. But and the parties we had parties. The very capable black woman who was the organiser for the Pretoria area, a party the Sunday night. Monday was the day of final briefing for the observers, and the election started on the Tuesday. Sunday night there was a party at her house in one of the townships, I think, a lovely house, and there was another party when it was all over. And at one of these parties, nearly all black people, but Sylvia, myself, and one or two other white people. There was another Wilf woman called Evelyn Mouse who had gone with a group of lawyers from the USA. So she wasn't strictly part of the Wilf delegation, but she was a Wilf woman who was there. But most of the people were the black volunteers. And at one stage there was a joke in which I couldn't understand. I didn't know what the language was. So I asked what it was and eventually said, somebody one had said, "I want to spit on the white woman's head." I don't think they meant me. I think she just meant, you know, their experiences with white people that they want to spit on their heads. So there was quite a lot of strong feeling there on both sides. But, you know, for me it was a very good experience, very good. I mean, it was, and I'd sort of, I must say, I walked around Pretoria. I say, I did find myself in this area. I thought, no, it's not really quite the thing for you to be here now on your own. But I had these two people helping me, both telling me to take care, both very caring people. But where is it now, you see? Where is South Africa now? It's the rich are still the ones that have the sway there. They might not all be white, it might be black rich as well, but there's still tremendous poverty in South Africa. And in Bolivia also, you know, in that, I've been to Congress in Bolivia. And Costa Rica. I've been to a meeting in Costa Rica. And in all these countries, yes. In Costa Rica, it was an IEC meeting. WILF has a Congress either every 3 years, it was, or 4 years, and then there's changes in order to make one at 2015. But in between time, and an international meeting in any part of the world, whatever country is willing to host an international meeting. And in the UK policy, we've always paid for our international rep to go there. If other people choose to go there at their own expenses, that's okay. I went to various congresses, but not generally to the IEC meetings, but one particular one, I think it was late 1998, our Thalia Campbell decided she wanted to stop being our international rep, so there was nobody official to send. So I don't know whether I think I decided I would go. I'm not sure. Rosalie Hussard and I both went. I went as the official IEC rep, so I was paid for in that respect. Rosalie Hussard was a very prominent person in Orpington as a Labour member and as a Quaker, and because of her husband's work. So she was funded by people in Orpington to go. I want to establish at the point that we only paid for one as a section, but other people might have gotten there. So she was funded and we both went, and she worked hard as well as I did. And the theme at that international meeting was the maquila workers, the women who work in sweatshops in various parts of the world. And that was also a very informative meeting and very distressing when you heard the stories of these women, the stories of a woman who had to leave her child with a 3 or 4 year old toddler with enough food in the back garden so that she could continue to go to work, of women giving birth on the floor of the sweatshop because they weren't allowed, not being allowed time to go to the toilet, the lives that they lived. I mean, what you read about here, but these were these women telling it themselves about, you know, almost sleeping on the workshop floor. So that was, a very thought-provoking meeting. And I mean, it's all to do with trade, isn't it? We buy our clothes, and these clothes are still made by people working in sweatshops. Weather conditions are quite as bad as those, they probably are still, but I just can't remember all the stories they told us, but those two in particular stand out. The woman that had to leave her child, a toddler, with food locked up somewhere or in a back garden or somewhere so that she could go to work. And the low wages, the long hours. And they also were the women themselves that were talking to us about them. And there were one or two trade union officials, and they would have lost their jobs for working for trade unions. So it certainly, you know, I still sort of wonder about that. But also they said, don't stop buying, we need the work. Carry on buying, but protest against it. But buy the stuff because we need the work. And now we still hear about these fires in these factories in far-off parts of the world because their safety is not considered. So it's all going on, you know, whatever clothes I'm wearing now, quite likely bought from a sweatshop worker. So I, in the past, I've written letters to... to these firms. I mean, mail orders are very, very convenient, and I've not written any for a long time. At one time I would have written letters to say, what kind of wages are you paying for? And I think these issues are important to Wilf. Food, clothing. The 1995 Congress, the theme there was racism, and the peace train went from there to Beijing. There's been big meetings every 10 years related to women. Now, what are they called? There's the acronym CSW is Commission on the Status of Women. Commission CEDAW, Committee for the Eradication of Discrimination Against Women. But these issues have been discussed at 10-year intervals at big meetings, whose names I can't remember, but there was one in Beijing that year in 1995. I think the first one was 1975, because Wilf women have always been involved in those. I mean, one of the earlier ones I remember hearing UK Wilf women talk about, all sort of pushing the issues of women that bit farther on. So this peace train was to go from Beijing across countries. And I've got 20... photographs of it, because Helen Harris, who went on it, took photographs and gave me a batch of 20 afterwards, A4, and I've got them there. I'm wondering what to do with them. But the Congress before it started, there had been accusations of racism within Wilf. So there'd been quite a furore, quite a lot of discussion at the Congress, and I think those discussions went on the peace train. I would have liked to have gone on it, but I decided that I needed to get my own affairs in order, and I was moving from Orpington to Croydon that year, and decided I couldn't take anything on else on that year until I got the move done. And I moved, and then I went to Congress. And then decided to see if there were any spare places on the train. Well, there were, but I couldn't get the documents to go to China. I could have got the documents to go through the other countries, but I couldn't get the one to go to China, so I couldn't go on it. But two women from Wilkes, UK, Helen Harris and Thalia Campbell, went on it, and so I heard quite a lot about it afterwards. But I think this issue of racism had been so intense that they were actually, you know, because there were accusations about women within, that they were more or less sworn to secrecy about some, you know, they were told, you know, asked not to talk too much, so as not to make it too personal. I think there can be so much, what's the word? Well, we call it institutional racism in this country, don't we? But like paternalism, like men don't always realise that they're being patronising to women with hair. Don't you worry about it, dear, we'll do this for you. I think there's a lot been racism of that kind, where people in this country say, oh, we want to help you, we'll do this for you, instead of saying, what do you want us to do? And I think, you know, that is actually a part, kind of racism, even though we don't see it as such. So I think to sort of black people, coloured people, and again, what word shall I use? Because sometimes you're not expected to use coloured, you use blue, and other times you're expected to use black and not coloured. I don't know. But I don't want to be offensive, but these words are acceptable for a time and they're not acceptable. And it's a pity. It's just like disability. You know, what words do you use? There was the phrase differently abled rather than disabled. And, you know, why do we worry about these words? Anyway, racism is not acceptable, in my opinion. But sometimes, I'm sure myself, I have been unintentionally racist with a black woman friend of mine that I've had for many, many years, who wasn't so well educated either. And I'm sure I have in the past thought, no, can I help you? Shall I do things my way? Instead of saying, no, you know, I must listen to you, not tell you what I think, you know. I think that is quite something we don't always realise. And it's something that the NGOs used to do at one time, even the ones that are doing a lot of good work, the development NGOs, going to developing countries and say, oh, we'll dig a well for you. This is what we'll do, this is how we do it, instead of saying, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to dig a well? Where do you want us to dig it? How? Who's going to, you know, instead of asking those questions, saying, we know how to do, we've got the techniques, we've got the technology. There's been a lot of that. I think those organisations have realised to some extent, but I think it's probably a lesson that people have to go on learning all their lives, that the new people have to learn. You know, new people come along, oh, I'm quite lucky, I'm very knowledgeable, I know how to do things. I'll show these people how to do them. Instead of saying that other people might know better than you in spite of your education and your advantages. Yeah. I think I'm talking too much. Anyway, I'd say I do want to pay tribute to all the Wilf women working at all levels, and not just WILP women, because WILP for me is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. The end, which will probably never be achieved, is peace and justice. So there are women in other organisations, and there are men who are working for these issues as well, and I think we should pay tribute to them also. What do you think about this recent trouble in France? Whose fault is it? Was it this Charlie that put out harmful, painful cartoons? Was he at fault? I don't know. It made me think a lot more about this time when I first became president in 1998, and I was determined to do something about this woman who had made this racist remark. And I thought she should either apologise or be forced out of Wilf. And then I realised a lot of Wilf and thought, no, you can't force anybody out. You have to have freedom of expression. So it's made me think a lot more about that. But I think there's a difference between freedom of expression at large and freedom of expression if you belong to a group that is committed to peace and justice. So I think I was right, but maybe I didn't handle the situation very well. But I think I was right in thinking that people who make racist remarks as Wilf members should either apologise or be removed. And we did set up a sort of a procedure for which we've never used. We set up a procedure by which we could remove from the organisation anybody who didn't, who did make that kind of remark and didn't apologise. We haven't used it. There was another woman who was offensive in other ways. She actually left of her own accord after I'd made apologies on her behalf for calling one of our government ministers a liar in a paper that she had written herself but circulated as a Wilf paper. That was in the days of the UK Trade Network, when I thought she was so capable that I could leave and leave her to it, because she was knew so much more than I did. But when she did that kind of thing, which was not acceptable. Yeah. So these are the strong women that we have to be wary of. You know, there are very strong women who don't know where to draw the line between working for peace and offending.
You've spoken about listening. As part of the work of Wilf. Would you care to elaborate
anything
about that?
Oh, yes. When I went to Cancun, as a very ignorant woman, not knowing a lot about the details of these trade agreements, but only knowing that women weren't having enough say, the UK government, the trade minister was Patricia Hewitt at that time. She held briefings, I think nearly every evening, for all members of the UK delegations that went there. So I went to these meetings. But also during the day, I went to various other meetings. And I'd been to one meeting where a woman from one of the African countries, can't remember which, but she had talked very well, very eloquently, about women in her country having to grow a crop which normally they would have used for themselves on a subsistence basis, but having to trade it with the women from a neighbouring country growing the same crop. So in the past they would have used the crop for themselves and they would have been considered unemployed or, you know, self, just feeding themselves. And they were being forced to trade this. She said they called it swap, you know, identical foods. So I did raise this issue at one of the these briefings held by Patricia Hewitt. Well, I think they were quite flabbergasted, really. And all Patricia Hewitt could say was, trade is good. So I was able to do things like that, to draw attention to that. There was another meeting where Mary Robinson, highly esteemed human rights representative, I mean, think at the time, I think she was the person at the UN for human rights, and she gave a talk. And there were lots of side things going on all the way around. And so I asked the question, why could the human rights, why could we not act on the basis of human rights against these trade organisations that were overruling the human rights of people in the developing countries? And her answer was that the instruments are there in the UN, it's just up to people to use them, kind of thing. That's what she didn't really have a direct answer to my question, really. Why could we not force these countries who had signed up to various human rights agreements to honour them? No. So those are the only bits that I did there. I mean, it was an experience for myself. I don't regret it at all, but what good it did in general, I don't know. I think it did make even some of the bodies in the UK trade network, I think it made them realise to some extent that the women's issues weren't just a case of, well, you must help the women. It's more a case of involving them, not helping them. Just as racism isn't a case of, oh, we look after you kind of thing. It's a case of respecting them and getting to know them and as people. I think we've exhausted everything, haven't we? I don't know.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I did say that I wasn't going to talk about my early childhood because we never talked about politics in my family, never. So I was never politically... I think sometimes the men did, maybe this was a bit of sexism, part of it, but it wasn't... I mean, I didn't have any brothers that time anyway, so we didn't talk about politics and we didn't talk about war. And we didn't have television till quite late on, or we lived in the country, didn't even have radio for a time. And during the war, they wanted me to do my homework, and so we wouldn't have the radio on, kind of thing. So I was really quite ignorant. But I suspect that my mother would have been a pacifist if she'd known the word. When we did have television later on, she never wanted any war scenes on, never any violence. And I didn't know till quite late in life that her fiancé was killed during the 1914 war. Never talked about that. She never mentioned it, but I just heard up. So I suspect she was a pacifist at heart, but she knew nothing about these. And my father, well, I don't know, when I asked him about his experiences in the war, he just sort of brushed them aside. He said, oh, I was just stationed in London. But he lost his first wife in the flu epidemic in 1919. And I suppose he was still, I don't know. So they both had unhappy experiences. And although they we'd never heard of women's international peace and freedom, and we never thought of pacifism or never thought of anti-war action, I suspect that probably at heart they would have been. I don't think my father would have refused to be enlisted. I mean, he was too old to be joining the 1939 war. I don't know what he thought of conscientious objectors, I don't know. I wish I knew now, yes. No, that's all I can say. So thank you for patiently listening to me and talking about talking for such a long time.
Not at all.
Would you not like a coffee now? Or a drink of anything, tea or anything?
Yeah, why not?
sitting next to me, to watch as much as anything. So I'll go around here then.
So that's rounding off session two. Zoe Perry and Margaret Turner. On Thursday, the 15th of January, 2015.